morning. This is the January 29th edition of Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller. My co-host, Doug Wells, is on assignment this morning. Filling in for him is Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Renee, and thanks to all our listeners here for tuning us in on this first day of the post-Sundance letdown. Here's a menu of what's ahead. First, as we all know, Park City is not only the land of fabulous skiing, but also where our nonprofit organizations thrive. Joining us in the studio this morning is the leader of the perhaps most well-known philanthropic organization in Park City, the Park City Community Foundation, Katie Wright. And Tom Raffa, who's a member of the Community Foundation's board, but he's also a CPA and the founder and CEO of Raffa, which is the nation's largest finance and accounting firm dedicated exclusively to social change clients. He's a wealth of knowledge. They're going to tell us about Utah and a recent report called The Giving State on Utah's philanthropic landscape. It's hot off the presses, and we're letting our listeners hear about it first, here today on Mountain Money.
That's going to be a great conversation. Then our second guest has quite a few heads turning as they walk through the Gateway Center. Maybe if you've been handling the past several weeks before Sundance took over the area, you've noticed a wall of roses in the window across from the restaurant. Inside are some pretty beautiful dresses, and they are magical. Park City Bridal, that's the new store. They offer high-end couture, bridal, and evening wear. We'll talk to Tatiana Zuniga about her new store.
And finally, after 8 years on Main Street, a family restaurant has moved literally to Deer Valley. We'll talk to the owners of Reefs about their evolution in Park City's restaurant scene.
That's all ahead on Mountain Money. Before we take our first break, I want our listeners to know a little bit about you, Roger. You've become kind of the third host of this show. You fill in regularly when Doug and I need to be away. Thank you for that. So I wanted our listeners to know a little bit more about you. I'll start the introduction by saying you're a member of the KPCW Board of Trustees. I know I call you a lot for help. Your background as a corporate lawyer has been really helpful to the station.
And while I, like most people, would be happy to talk about myself for a long period of time, let me just give you a brief comment. I bought my first condo here in Park City in 1989 and have had a presence here ever since. My family moved here about 15 years ago, and for a while I had the joys of airplane commuting between Park City and Washington, D.C., where I was a partner in a law firm representing corporations being investigated by the federal government and defending cases brought by the likes of Rod Rosenstein and Jim Comey and Bob Mueller. So I follow with interest the current developments, given my background in dealing with those kinds of characters.
So you have an inside look on how corporations operate, especially within the boundaries of our federal laws, yeah?
I like to think so, and I guess some other people did because they were willing to hire me.
Well, we're lucky to have you here. Mountain Money will be right back after these messages.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
And this is Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller here with my co-host Roger Goldman. And our first guest, we're very lucky to have Katie Wright, the leader of the Park City Community Foundation, and a member of the Park City Community Foundation's board, Tom Raffa. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
So we wanted to start kind of at a 30,000-foot level. And Katie, we wanted you just to remind our listeners, you said this is something you do every year with Leadership 101. What's the purpose of philanthropy, if I can say it right?
Yeah, as someone who absolutely loves philanthropy, the basic idea is an agreement between the federal government and taxpayers that we get to make choices as citizens of what public good we want to see in the community. We can make donations, and the federal government, in turn gives us a tax deduction for that. And nonprofits are bound to deliver on that public good. And for me, I really see it as democracy in action because it's about individual choice and it's about creating the community or the nation that you want to live in and that you want to see.
And from the donor's perspective, you know, going beyond the sort of government tax implications, what do you believe that people want to accomplish by being engaged in philanthropic activities?
I think they want to see things change. And you know, someone told me once that they start with their clients and they say, open up the newspaper and circle in red everything you want to see less of and circle with green everything you want to see more of and start your philanthropy there. And I think that that's what it's all about, is what are you passionate about? What changes do you want to see on behalf of your neighbors and making that change happen?
And how does the Park City Community Foundation help people with that?
So we do a couple things. First and foremost, we provide philanthropic services. So we offer donor advised funds and other charitable giving tools. And along with them comes a lot of knowledge about what is happening here in Park City. And of course, the ability to do research and connect people with things that are happening nationally as well. So we serve as people's back office and knowledge base to make sure that their donations have impact. And we also provide a lot of support to the nonprofit community in terms of platforms like Live PC, Give PC, education and ongoing education for the people working for nonprofits. And then, of course, grant making, our key service. And then finally, you know, we really believe that some problems are bigger than one nonprofit's mission, that it really takes all hands on deck, the government, business sector, and nonprofits working together to really get at those hard issues, like, for instance, mental health, something we've been involved in for the past year. So the Community Foundation is a great convener that can get all the leaders in the room to really look at a long-term, enduring solution to some of these really hard challenges.
Now, you started by making a comment about the relationship between the individual donor and the federal government and the tax impacts. And with the recent tax bill, I understand that there have been some changes to that relationship and some concerns by the philanthropic community about the potential impact. Tom, can you explain a little bit about how that's working and what to expect here?
Sure. With one of the advantages that they gave us, they took away another that may have a potential harm to the nonprofits and to the charitable contributions they're getting. Right now, under the old law, we were allowed to deduct up to 50% of our charitable contributions through itemizing on our Schedule A. They moved that to 60%. But in increasing the standard deduction up to $12,000 for single and $24,000 for married, there's a less likelihood for people to itemize. Also, in itemization, there were some things taken away, limitations on mortgages and state, which would also, again, reduce your ability to itemize. It's estimated that that reduction goes from about 37 million people to about 16 million people in 2018 that would itemize. Given that, the decision needs to be made whether you would then give to a charity where you wouldn't get a federal deduction for it. And while the jury's still out on that, there's estimates that that could go as high as $20 billion a year in estimated deductions. We think as a CPA firm that it's probably going to be obviously a lot of the smaller donors. A lot of our wealthy people don't call me and say, can I get a deduction for this or is it going to hit my alt-min? But, you know, at the end of the day, there's probably a lot of smaller groups that are encouraged to give because they feel like they're partnering with the government in it and it's almost like a little bit of a match. And if that gets eliminated, it could be severe for the sector.
And just so we understand, your wealthier donors are going to tend to are still going to itemize even with the higher standard deduction, correct?
True, but also I think that they tend, you know, most of the higher philanthropists also hit alternative minimum taxes, so they really are not looking at it, calling me at the end of the year and saying I want to give $150,000 to the symphony. Is it going to work? You know, so, but, you know, again, probably some of the lower people that in the lower income classes are looking forward to that deduction when they contribute to their local nonprofits, to their churches.
So you've addressed what the impacts are to the individual under this new tax code. What about nonprofits themselves? How are they going to be taxed differently, if at all?
Well, there's a lot of changes in that we were expecting that didn't go through, which is good news. Some of the things that went through were to set up parities between what's going on in the changes in the law or prior law with corporations that are for-profit entities that are obviously paying tax, and the nonprofit groups. And I'm not sure I agree that there should be a parity between the groups because they serve different needs in within the sector, but within our country. But I think that the government, for instance, for one thing right now, if you're a publicly traded company under the old laws, you would not get a deduction for anything payments over $1 million in compensation for C-level people. The law change, the significant law change for nonprofits is that if you're making over $1 million, you'd have to pay a 21% tax on anything you paid your C-level people over $1 million. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, and what nonprofit is paying that?
Exactly,
but
yeah.
When you look at some of the nonprofits that are larger, that are competing with groups like other healthcare groups, salaries do get to be more significant. Also, a lot of them have retirement benefits that are all taxable as soon as forfeiture, the risk of forfeiture is lifted. And not to get real technical, that means that when you retire, all of a sudden, everything that you've saved or your employer has saved for you over the years would become taxable at that point. That could be over $1 million easily if it's pension money and you've been your tenure at an organization, even a small organization, has been 25, 30 years. So those are the ones that we're concerned about the most.
And I suppose the people who have to worry about that most are private school football coaches and senior executives at not-for-profit healthcare systems. Let's talk a little bit about, we talked about larger donors versus smaller donors and how there can be a differential tax impact. Turn to the Community Foundation for a minute. Let's talk a little bit about, at a high level, what your sense is between large donors and smaller donors in terms of your donor base.
You know, we are a relatively young community foundation as compared to them across the nation, and we've always been really focused on participation. So with Live PC, Give PC, and our Women's Giving Fund, it's been really important to us to have those programs accessible to all sorts of donors. I mean, part of our role is to encourage philanthropy among all people. And Live PC, Give PC with a minimum donation of $5 is really accessible to everyone. So we see a lot of our donations from the under $500 range, and I'm sure that many of the nonprofits feel the same way. And to me, the importance of that is building that philanthropic pipeline, getting people even at a young age to think, I have a role in giving back to my community, and getting used to the joy of giving back even before they're able to make really significant gifts.
Let's transition, if we can, to The Giving State, your 2017 report on Utah's philanthropic landscape. This is brand new, isn't it?
It is.
Can you tell our listeners, how did you come up with this study? What's the science behind this?
So I was a participant in the study, but not among the writers. But their idea was that Utah is number one in philanthropic giving across the nation, and also number one in volunteerism. So the question posed by this report is, of the, I believe it's $3.5 billion given here in the state annually. Now I want to check that statistic, but I'll come back to it.
And just for context, want to remind our listeners that a large part of that is because of the activity of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Of course. The question is, if, for example, the $3.5 billion in annual donations throughout this state were twice as effective. So that's really the heart of this report, is how, not necessarily raising more dollars, but making each dollar have a more significant impact in this state.
And one of the things I thought was interesting in the takeaways was, don't assume that doing good inevitably makes things better. Instead, focus and invest on the people you are serving and outcomes and the results that you want to see. So sometimes good intentions don't necessarily translate to the most effective outcome. And as a leader of a nonprofit, I thought that was a big takeaway from this. How do you help nonprofits achieve the results that they want? Or what are the suggestions that come out of this report for that?
So one of the things, well, to back up, I think the report is really focused both on donors and the nonprofits and sort of the marriage between those two folks, and which I think is really important. And I think one of the things it says is measure, evaluate, and be willing to change. That being flexible and adaptable, iterative in your work is really, really critical. And the tough part about that is who funds that? Who funds measurement and evaluation? And especially working in the context of Park City, where most of our nonprofits are essentially small grassroots organizations, I think it can be hard because the databases and the software are quite expensive. However, an investment now, I think, does equal impact down the road.
And Tom, as a CPA, you must see this with the companies and nonprofits you work for. Like a Recycle Utah, the measurement of what they do is a lot more, I would think, easy than a Summit Community Power Works, where theirs is more proving a negative. How many people conserved energy thanks to Summit Community Power Works versus how many people recycled thanks to Recycle Utah? How does a nonprofit evaluate the best way to evaluate?
Yeah, we work a lot with our nonprofits in helping to build capacity. And in doing that, we're trying to set up the metric for success up front. So that if you look at something like where we're doing work at Eastern High School, which is in Ward 6 in D.C., there's a 48% dropout rate when we got there. If our goal is to say that no kid will end up on the street, so 100% graduation or at least a vocational or to the arm or to the military, you know, and we're moving toward that, there's a lot of different ways to get there. And I think when we set the metric up in the beginning, as long as we're testing the work that we're doing and the 5 to 10 to 15 steps there, and we believe a lot in the collective impact of the community. There's no way that anybody's going to fix this problem one-on-one. And so me bringing together corporate leadership to do this is not enough. It's then funding nonprofits that know how to do this, and then it's a constant measurement. I think a lot of times under the old systems, a foundation, for instance, would give 3 years of funding and say, come back to us. And I think social investment and social impact has changed a lot of the thinking, because we're looking at that and saying, we're going to invest $1 million in your startup company, but we want to know every quarter how it's going. And so with that, we can make changes on the fly, and that's a lot better. We could try these things. We agree as partners they should get us to our goal of 100% graduation, and if they don't, let's fix them now. Let's not wait 3 years after we've spent the dollars. And I think more of that occurring is really what we're about, even as a firm, is if we can measure that and continually measure it, it is quantifiable. Even though some of it's qualitative, it can be determined. And I think those kinds of shifts on the fly are really going to make philanthropy a lot more impactful.
Now, you talked a little bit about the importance of accountability and feedback at the foundation level. To what extent are we seeing more desire for that kind of impact feedback at the individual donor level? Are donors really looking to see what's happening with the organizations they give to?
Yeah, there's a serious demand for it. I think Katie hit it on the head when there's a demand for it, yet there's not this sense of wanting to pay for it or having dollars. Back when I first started, capacity building was a big thing. Nobody really wanted to pay for it. They just wanted to build capacity, but there weren't capacity building grants, and if they were, they were segregated from a regular grant. Same thing happens here. If somebody gives dollars, it's often very hard to say, give us 15% to measure the effectiveness of the dollars you're giving. And so I think that's where groups like us come in, where we can develop those kind of tools for people and then report back. But it is a changing, I think, of the mindset.
Are we seeing a trend now toward where donors are looking to give more than money? In other words, where they're trying to have both a financial role and a participatory role in the philanthropic projects that they adopt?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a market change in the way that baby boomers gave versus folks who maybe made their money in the tech boom. Really different. And baby boomers tended to give in a more loyal fashion and more unrestricted giving, whereas, tech boom, just to use one segment, are more active in their philanthropy. And both can be quite great. And so I think we should be important, like say there's not one approach is better or worse. But I think what Tom said is what's really important is to feel like you're entering in a partnership with this, that you and the nonprofit share a vision of the shared outcome, and that you're both willing to invest what it takes to get to the outcome, not, hey, I want you to deliver on this, but you can only spend my money this way. Because that's when problems start to arise. And there's something called the starvation cycle, which is basically when nonprofits are putting all their money into programs but aren't investing into their, into capacity building of their staff, so there's high turnover or evaluation. So maybe they're doing this program, really, really intensely, but it's actually not achieving results and no one really knows. So it's important to kind of be holistic in giving and holistic in how these organizations grow and operate.
And I to add to that too, I don't want the legacy of our generation in the sector to be that we kept indirect costs down. I think at the end of the day, there's a lot more to having impact and to build infrastructure. So we encourage our philanthropic clients, for instance, if they're going to give $200,000 to cancer research, that they maybe give it for fundraising, because in fundraising, they could raise another $4 million for research. And that is usually is not the way people think. The other thing I'll add to about the newer generation is that they're very mission focused. So, where we used to give to the American Red Cross, and still I have older clients that in their wills, they'll name name specific nonprofits. Generally, in my among my staff, about 67% of my staff are under 32. They all want to give to a particular purpose, to resolve the issue around homelessness, for instance. And it's our job to figure out who are the best nonprofits that can collaborate together and fix the homelessness problem in D.C. And they want to give to that particular purpose as opposed to a particular nonprofit.
That's an interesting approach. Who would they put in their will to be the one to figure out how to allocate the money? Is that you?
Park City Community Foundation.
and to use a very living example in our community right now is that we have a community that is rightfully so very focused on mental health and substance abuse right now, right? We received a wake-up call and have to do better for our kids and our families. And so the Community Foundation, because we have unrestricted donors, we're able to take one of our staff members and say, clear everything off your desk and get all the partners in the room, which include business, hospitals, government. There wasn't really a place to take your mental health or substance abuse dollar and give it in this community. And we started a mental health fund, and we've seen Rob Katz and Alana Amsterdam give to it. We just had a local business owned by Sloan Reed make a contribution. And we're able to take the partners together and say, okay, one of the highest best uses right now is people who are bilingual counselors. So let's fund that at the Christian Center and at Jewish Family Services. You know, we have a very well-functioning drug court, but they have more people than they can fund right now. Okay, let's put some funding there. And so we're able to make sure that those dollars are, I guess, well allocated to the highest and best use right now. And our partners are at the table in those conversations.
Another part in this report is the effectiveness of communication, both to the people who are giving you money and the community at large. Other than coming on KPCW and talking about what nonprofits are doing, how is a nonprofit going to best spread their message?
Well, first of all, KPCW does an amazing job, and I truly believe that the marketing budgets of every nonprofit are significantly lower because of this community asset, so we're really appreciative of that. I think that site visits, both for donor and nonprofits, are so powerful because whenever you're speaking at an event or the radio, you know, you get your number one issue out of your mouth and not much else. But if you just spend an hour with one of the nonprofits that you give to and you're passionate about, first of all, that ED would love to spend that hour with you. You will learn so much more about the hopes, aspirations, the barriers, and I think then we'll build a deeper partnership. And then the nonprofit also gets to learn about you and what are your skill sets and things like that. So we do site visits every year, and we encourage people to come along with us. And I would also say, don't be shy. Call up your favorite nonprofit and say, can I come sit down for an hour or walk around your programs and just really touch and feel it?
Are you seeing an increased trend of the people who are giving money wanting to see some deliverables as a result of their money?
Yeah, and I honestly believe that has to do with with social impact investing. You know, we've been working a lot with larger groups like Bain and Goldman Sachs on the $114 billion that's private market assets that are meant for social impact. And so the same way an investor would look for a dollar return, while dollar returns are less, and maybe you're looking for 10 instead of a 30% venture capital return, the other 20% has to be measured for those investors. And I think those investors are getting wiser about their philanthropic dollars as well. And so we're going to start to see much, much more of that. And I would agree, though, if you can participate and be a part of it, it again, to share in the growth that's happening, and to help to direct a little bit around the impact, I think that's a positive thing for people because I think it's not just the money. And a lot of times it's also that commitment that helps. And people do need skill sets and volunteerism. We do probably about 10% of our gross revenue as a firm in pro bono skilled services. It's hard, again, and part of it is to build this capacity up. So when you talk about getting the word out to organizations for about nonprofits, the great thing here is the giving guide that's done by the Park City Community Foundation. We have a similar catalog for philanthropy in D.C., and it's meant for smaller organizations that don't have the time, money, or knowledge to get the word out about the good work that they're doing in the community, because it is a lot of the smaller community-based organizations that are having the most effective change on our communities.
Well, thank you. We've had a wonderful segment this morning with our guests, Katie Wright and Tom Raffa.
And just real quick before we wrap up, was there some point that you guys wanted to make, either about the Giving State report? I know we're going to be talking about more tomorrow, Anything else you want our listeners to know?
I mean, one quick plug for the Donor Advised Fund vehicle. I think there's a lot of people saying, okay, how is tax reform going to affect my charitable giving? I would say this is a tool that if you're not familiar with, you should look into. The Community Foundation provides them, as does most major, you know, financial firms like Fidelity and whatnot. But it's something to give consideration to, and I'd be happy to talk about the pros and cons of that tool.
And Tom, any takeaway you want to
add? I would add to that. I think that the nonprofits need to be creative. They can think about starting for-profit subsidiaries that can draw different kinds of investments in for the good work that they're doing. And I think as a philanthropist, if you look at donor-advised funds as opposed to setting up a foundation and spending all of that those indirect costs that don't need to be spent in a group that is going to monitor and carry on your wishes over a period of time, even though the nonprofits they work with might change, I think that's a positive thing.
Tom Raffa, CEO of Raffa, also a board member of the Park City Community Foundation, and Katie Wright, head of the Park City Community Foundation. Thank you so much for your
time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to talk high-end bridal gowns when we come back.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud KPCW supporter.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller here with Roger Goldman, my co-host today. Thanks for being here, Roger.
Good morning.
We're going to talk, I know, something that's top of mind for you. High-end couture, bridal, and evening wear. We have Park City Bridal in studio with us, Tatiana Zuniga. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I'm very excited to talk about Park City Bridal and couture and bridal dresses. So
the store is beautiful.
Thank you.
The Wall of Roses. I have to ask about that. That was a head turner. Everyone I know in town was saying, "What's going?" Because you had that Wall of Roses up, really, I think, before you put a shingle up.
Yes. Yeah, so that flower wall is imported from Shanghai, and it took about several days to make, and to put up.
So is it going to stay there?
It's going to stay there. It's one of our signature pieces, besides what we sell. And we're very excited. We opened up the store in January and have had a lot of good feedback. We would want more people to know about us, and we're hoping that this will do it.
Tell us a little bit about what it is that you do sell.
So we sell high-end bridal dresses between $2,500 to $11,000. And they're very couture. They're all custom handmade. Some of our designers are from Israel or New York or places like, let me see, who else do we have?
What are some of the brand names?
The brand names is Liz Martinez, Idan Cohen, Danny Mizrahi. Mm-hmm. He actually made the dress for Gal Gadot, who played Wonder Woman. And we have Alexander Greco. We have Eve of Malati from New Jersey. And we have about 10 designers in total.
I just heard Roger have a big gulp over here as the father of a young woman. When you said $11,000, I heard a big gulp. You know, Roger, something to look forward to, right?
Yeah. Is the inventory exclusively bridal, or will you also be selling other kinds of fashionable
Most
wear?
Of it is bridal. We have some evening wear for that very special gal who wants to have a nice dress, and it's all custom, so sizes can range, and you know, the fit is very custom. Mm-hmm. It's very unique to that person. So if they like what they see, they can order it, or they can buy some of the evening pieces off rack.
And do you have seamstresses on staff? So someone comes in and they try on, and then you make sure it fits like a glove.
Yeah, that's what makes us so special, is we want to cater to a higher end client, and we want them to have this very unique experience to where they don't have to go to another location, because that's what's happening now with other bridal stores. They don't have like an in-house seamstress to help them. So it kind of cuts down on the experience and the travel and the time. And
you must have done some market research that showed that Park City had a need for a store like this.
Oh, yeah.
But how did you find that out?
You know, it's just something that's just like obvious. You don't see it in Main Street. You don't see it in Park City. You're like, wait a minute. There's no store here. There's no bridal. Why?
There's a store on Main Street where you can spend at least $5,000 for a dress. I think we all know which store that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, not they don't have bridal gowns.
Yeah. And something so custom to where all of our designers are exclusive and we're really a bridal destination is something that Park City really needs. And I believe the girls here would love that.
So. Are you reaching out and marketing down in the valley as well?
We are doing Google, Facebook, Instagram, the social media related marketing and advertisements. But, you know, we don't find our clients are coming a lot from Salt Lake. We find them traveling from out of state, or they're tourists, or they're like out of towners living in Park City. But I mean, we welcome everybody. It's just what we found has been working for us.
We certainly see a fair number of destination weddings here in Park City during the summer, and it'll be interesting. To ask you how you could plan to try to market to that, that clientele.
Well, we work with the hotels. We've met them. We've invited them to the grand opening. Stein was at our grand opening, and Deer Valley was there too, I believe. And you know, they need vendors like us. Because when their clients come in from out of town, they're like, where do we go?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's hard for them to drive all the way down to Salt Lake. And, you know, some brides don't want to drive down to Salt Lake. Some brides are in Park City and they don't want to go to New York or L.A. They want to stay here. So that's really why we're here, to fulfill that need.
If they do find something in New York or L.A., or let's say they're flipping through a catalog, a magazine, a bridal magazine, and they see something they like, can they come to you to see if you can order it for them, and then they just work with you for the fittings?
If we carry that designer, yes.
Okay.
If we don't carry that designer, unfortunately, we really can't do that for many inventory boring stuff. But most of the time, we can order if it's our designer, and if it's not in our store, we can order basically anything. They would just be like a shipping and fee, and that's it.
Or alternatively, you could try to find something that looks like what they've got.
Exactly. Yeah, you got it.
Good shopper, Roger. So walk us through the timeline. When somebody wants to buy a wedding dress, you just can't walk in and then walk out with a dress usually, right?
Well, you can, but that's not our store, right? Our store, our dresses take about 6 months to make because they're all made by hand.
Wow.
And they're usually imported from other states and countries, basically. So you would come in for the fitting, you would order your dress, put 50% down, and then the designer gets the measurements, and then they start to work on your dress. It would, in total, it would take about 7-8 months to have your dress fully made. And that's with a lot of planning. That's with a bride who wants to, like, you know, like Maggie Vessie, she's here and she's Instagramming me live.
Hi, Maggie. Maggie's in studio with us.
Hi, Maggie.
She actually went out of town to get her dress at Boca Raton Bridal, where I got my dress. And, you know, she planned and she traveled and she took her time to find that dress, to get it custom made, the work for the seamstress. It takes about a month. So it just takes a lot of preparation. But obviously, if a bride is in a pinch, she can always figure something out. And I mean, we can always work with that too, but we prefer to have our brides have enough time so they're not stressed out.
And what is your background? How did you get into this business?
You know, I got into this because I got married at the Vizcaya Museum and Gardens in Miami back home.
Beautiful.
And I really wanted to bring that experience to the girls here because I live here now. And I want it to be the change that I wanted to see. I want the girls in Park City to have that option to come to a really nice store, be catered to like they would in New York or LA, you know, because that's what I'm used to. And that's what I want to give to the girls who come to my store. I want to give them that experience that, you know, like, wow, you know, this place is like really catering to me.
What brought you to Park City?
Well, I got married to my husband, and now I just live here full time.
So you married someone from Park City then?
Yeah, yeah, I did, yeah.
And he brought you from Miami to the snow?
Yeah, well, sort of, yeah. You can see that.
And how many employees do you have now?
I have two. I have a salon manager, and she runs the day-to-day, and then I have our seamstress, Tony, and he's exceptional. And he's worked with so many bridal stores. So our team really is very niche. This business is very niche. So it's really hard to find, quote, right people. Mm. And, you know, the experience we give to the clients because of that is just that much better.
And can someone just walk in or do they need to make an appointment?
I would prefer an appointment, but obviously, walk-ins are what we need right now, and we need people to know about our store, so we're flexible.
What are your business hours?
It's Tuesday to Saturday, 10 to 6:30 p.m., and we have a website where you can make an appointment online, so you don't need to call us. And
want to give us the address of the website?
Oh, yeah, parkcitybridal.com. And that's how we're found on social media, too, Park City Bridal. Park City Bridal, hashtag Park City Bridal. That's our name, Park City Bridal.
So the Facebook page, the Instagram
Everything.
Account, Park City Bridal, spelled out.
Will you be doing any shows or fashion demonstrations?
Yes. You know, I'm glad you brought that up because we just had a trunk show, which is, it just means the designer gives us her entire bridal line and we can give 10% off during that time to any bride who wants to come in and get a dress. And we just had one for Sundance. We had Liz Martinez. And we should have one coming up in March for Danny Mizrahi, who made the wedding dress for Gal Gadot, the Wonder Woman, yeah.
And if our listeners are out there biting their nails about how to deal with an upcoming wedding, could they get on a mailing list or somehow be invited to be able to come see that trunk show coming up? How would they do
that? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They would just go on our website and parkcitybridal.com and make an appointment because you have to make a reservation for a trunk show and or walk in during those 2 days. So, yeah. I mean, we're pretty easy. We're pretty accessible. And we want to give them a really high-end experience, so we're very flexible, and we need people to come in. So.
What kind of trends are you seeing in bridal fashion right now?
The very tight mermaids, very elegant, sophisticated. We've had three brides now who have bought very sleek and very, like, minimal kind of dress, and We've just seen that. Not so much the ball gowns, except for that one girl who has to make an appearance. You know, like Maggie. She had a little bit of a poofy poof going on.
Are you seeing brides wanting more than one dress?
Oh, yes. All the time. It's really hard to just have one dress, right? Why have one dress? Because you have your big entrance and then you have your party, mm-hmm. right? So you want more than one dress, but, you know, sometimes with the budget, it's kind of hard. So we've noticed right now just one dress and then maybe that one bride.
What about sleeves? I thought when Kate Middleton showed up with the pretty white lace sleeves that that would start a new trend. Are you seeing sleeves or do most brides want sleeveless?
We've had our brides with no sleeves.
Yeah.
And V-cuts and back showing.
Oh, wow.
So our brides are very unique. They're very confident. But we've had one or two people come in and ask about sleeves. We have that as well. We have Isabel Armstrong. She's from New York, and she does great buildup for the more conservative, you know.
For our LDS population here, they definitely want to be, you know, with sleeves and more covered. So
we have that.
You can be fashionable and look great with that as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're interested to see what really works, right? We are bringing in designers that we believe are high-end, are what girls want. But ultimately, it's whatever they tell us is going to happen.
Are you prepared for the more evening gowned market? So if we have some galas that are coming up, black tie, like mm-hmm. Red, White, and Snow is coming up. That's always a beautiful party. So a woman can go to you to find that great evening gown for that event?
Yes. Our evening gowns are more on the Israeli sexy side because it is from an Israeli line, and Israeli designers are more, look at me, I am here, and I'm here to show you who I am, kind of a dress, if that makes sense. So,
Israeli designers. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Israeli designers, like
who else would outfit Wonder Woman?
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah. Very good point.
Very, very sexy.
Well, we need to wrap it up, Tatiana. Okay. Anything else you want our listeners to know before you go?
Yes, I would like the listeners to know that we are open, that we're here to stay, and that we will take care of all your bridal needs, all your evening needs, and we are on call. So thank you for listening, and thank you guys for having me here. I really appreciate your time and the opportunity. Thank
you're
you.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here. Tatiana Zuniga, Park City Bridal. They're in the Gateway Center, open Tuesday to Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Look for parkcitybridal.com online. Mountain Money will be right back. We're going to have Reef's Restaurant in with us. Stay tuned.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays!
This is Chris Wissner, store manager of Jan's, a longtime supporter of KPCW. Jan's guides fly fishing excursions to local waters and private ranches. Our fly shop is stocked with the gear you need, and our guides are ready to take you to the river. Serving Park City for over 30 years, Jan's Mountain Recreation Experts. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
And you're listening to Mountain Money here on KPCW. Joining us in studio right now, some folks who've been in town for a long time, but they do have something new to talk about. We have Chef Aussie Yoked and Tally Yoked. Did I say Yoked right?
Yoked.
Yoked. Sorry.
It's okay.
From
it's all good.
Reef's Restaurant. Welcome, you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
During the break, we were talking about your history here in the Park City area. When did you start and where did you start?
We moved here from Tel Aviv in 2005 and opened our first location in Kimball Junction. Spent three seasons over there and decided to move up to Main Street in 2008 and had a great run on Main Street, and recently decided to make a change. And we were fortunate enough to meet some people from the Deer Valley Club. They invited us up, and we took the opportunity, and we opened there December 2nd.
And while I know Renee would get to this eventually, I know that my first question is, where exactly are you located, and how can I park there?
So we are located at the Deer Valley Club,
okay,
which is just past the main entrance to the Deer Valley Ski Resort at Silver Lake. And there is a parking garage, actually, at the DVC, where you can just park right there and go up to the third floor and come visit us.
So for our listeners who've never been to your restaurant, what's on the menu?
We are, historically, that's an interesting word. I'm only 46 talking about history, but historically, we've been Middle Eastern, Mediterranean kind of fare. And recently, I've been able to fuse our Mediterranean menu with some Japanese elements, actually. So we are also serving our own type of sushi. Chef Austin Hall, who's a good friend, who I'd met a few years back, decided to join the team. And we are fusing, you know, I don't even want to call it Mediterranean sushi or whatever you want to think. My experience is I don't like to be in a box when it comes to cooking. So we kind of, you know, fly. That's what I call it. We fly. I come in a restaurant, and the recipes are recipes, but we change stuff up all the time.
Well, you must have regulars who like certain staples that you have on the menu.
We do have staples, but they don't complain. You know, I think people, for the most part, if they love us, they love us, and they accept who we are. The flavors are the same with a little twist, and that's what I try to do. Keep it interesting for myself. Being in the kitchen for so many hours a day, you have to keep it interesting.
So what? Following up on Renee's question, what would you consider to be your staples? What do people come in and order again and again?
Well, I've had the Moroccan salmon on the menu for 14 years. I've had schnitzels on the menu for 14 years. I've had lamb chops on the menu for 14 years. Those would be the three staples. But everything on the menu is amazing. You know, I think if a person goes out to dinner, they got to leave their worries behind, just come in and eat. You know, they don't have to worry about what's on the menu or just come in and eat, enjoy it, and enjoy the food, enjoy the music, enjoy the smells.
Did you find that your clientele changed at all when you moved from the Junction to Main Street? And are you expecting to see any other kind of change with this move?
I think it's hard to tell. We've only been open for a month and a half. I'm sure our clientele is going to change, but people are people. So to me, right now, I can't judge. I'm not going to make assumptions on what's going to happen. I'm sure things are going to change, but change is good.
You were very visible in both of your prior locations, and the Deer Valley Club is probably less visual to casual passersby, which to me creates a marketing challenge. So I'm interested in, you know, what thoughts have you given to how to deal with that, other than the fact that some of us remember who you are and will follow you.
So the decision was made not just to change locations. It was also changing philosophy as far as what we're trying to do here in Park City. Park City provides us snow for about 4 months a year, and we are very busy. But in order to build a cash business or a retail business, because a restaurant, that's what we do, we have to maximize the time. And when I say that is, I would like to have a business that operates 12 months a year, not 4, 5, or 6. And the move up there was made for that reason. We have a huge kitchen, so we can provide catering, we can provide personal chefing parties. We're looking at the mountain bike scene up there in Deer Valley in the summer, hoping to draw a big crowd from that. We're going to build a beer garden in the space right now. That's really one of the decisions, was that. To go back just for a second, before we decided to go to the DVC, we were looking in Salt Lake. For that reason, we wanted to maximize our business. Again, we're a retail business. We got to be busy 12 months a year. Can't be busy 4, 5, 6 months. We have to provide for our children. So that's really it. I mean, the decision was made, even though I'm an artist, I'm a chef, money's involved here, and we had to make a move. You said we were visible before. you know, we were, but we weren't. Mm-hmm. You know, being on Main Street not doesn't necessarily mean you're visible. There's a lot more competition, so your visibility is limited in that aspect from my perspective, the way I look at things. I love Main Street, but I love the Deer Valley Club now.
What percentage of your business do you anticipate this year will be catering versus the restaurant or private chefing?
We don't know. The business plan that I built, the way it's looking right now, it looks like about 70% is going to be provided by the restaurant and 30% is going to be provided by the things. But I think I took a very I didn't take it too far. I didn't want to shoot for the sky yet. You know, I wanted to wait and see what happens after a year, and then I think we'll be able to make a better assumption as far as predictions for the following years.
If I'm interested in hiring you on for catering, what does that look like? What kind of food do you provide? What kind of services? What's the price range?
Anything you want.
Wow, I like that answer.
Anything you want. There's no, I mean, I do what I do. I'm good at what I do. I can cook any style of food. I can provide any type of atmosphere.
What's a recent catering experience you had that you enjoyed as well as the customer having a good experience?
Well, we've been doing sushi parties pretty much since December, since we've opened. We've probably done 15 of them already. The one I've enjoyed the most, I had one for five people about a week ago. And we did I think it was a 24-course dinner for five people. Yes, 24.
How long did that take?
We were there, I don't know, we were there from about 7 o'clock until 11 at night. Had a wonderful experience. You know, you can connect with the people that you're feeding. You can see their expressions, you know, on their faces. And it was amazing. Did I make money from it? Not necessarily, but the experience for me was amazing. I really enjoyed doing that. That gave me a lot for my soul. When I went home that night, I knew that I was doing the right thing.
And Tally, what role do you play at the restaurant?
I'm running the front of the house. Mm-hmm. So I'm making sure that people that are coming to the restaurant are going to be happy and going to get whatever they want. I'm doing it for the last 13 years, so I'm really familiar with our regular and with the need, and I'm really patient, and I don't know, I mean...
One of the biggest challenges we tend to hear from restaurant owners when we have them on the show is staffing. Do you guys find that that's difficult?
Yes, this is really challenging in our town. We actually hire new staff at least 2 to 3 times a year. I mean, just during the season, it's really, really hard to keep staff all year round because it's just so crazy, really busy, and then it's nothing, and so just people cannot commit to stay with you all year round. And in the same time, I don't think that the local really interested in working here. Enjoy the outdoor and enjoy this town.
That's why we work hard, though. I mean, I think me and my wife Talia, we wouldn't have this business if we didn't put in 17, 18 hours a day.
Wow.
That's the bottom line. I mean, if I can put Tali in a Xerox machine and make just another copy, it'd be amazing.
It is Utah. I guess you can have more than one wife if you want.
No,
honestly.
No. I didn't mean it in that manner. But, you know, you hit on a really interesting point. I can sit here and be all negative about it. But I'm not going to be, because this is what it is, okay? This is life. And you cannot expect other people to do anything that has to do with your dream. You have to do it yourself, bottom line. We have gone through so many different people through our business. I love them all, and I've had great experience. I've learned a lot from other people, But at the end of the day, if it wasn't for me and Tali, Reefs wouldn't be around.
Well, there you have it. We need to leave it there. Thank you, Chef Aussie Yokid and his wife Tali Yokid with Reefs Restaurant, now at Deer Valley Club. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974. FredMarshallPainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
I want to thank all of our sponsors today here on Mountain Money: Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Properties with Verdian Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And thank you to our guests, Katie Wright and Tom Raffa with Park City Community Foundation, Tatiana Zuniga with Park City Bridal, and Chef Ossie Yokid and his wife Tally Yokid with Reef's Restaurant. It's been a great hour. Roger Goldman, thanks for being here. We'll see you again next week.
I'm looking forward to it.
And you've been listening to Mountain Money here on KPCW Park City. NPR News starts right now.